concise Whitehall power. But first of all, I should again thank Rob and John for the hospitality and organizing and helping making this really enjoyable workshop. Again, to me, it's quite refreshing to see how an interesting problem like this, first of all, has a group of people that all are really interested in, and then second of all, that in the last few years, quite a bit of new ideas have been put forward. And for a topic like this, it's actually it's sort of remarkable, since it's been around. The puzzles with black holes and quantum mechanics have been around for quite a while, but just to me, this workshop really had a fresh feel to it, quite very encouraging. But having said that, I'm kind of going to move on a little bit from the question in my talk. Move on a little bit from the question of information, black holes and information, and start thinking about another interesting quantity, which is energy. Part of the motivation from this came from certain, I should say, maybe a more practical perspective that I started to adopt at some point. For example, if you talk to people who haven't thought about this particular type of questions outside of our field, for them, energy is obviously a more concrete phenomenon than information. It's hard to explain to a non-physicist or non-information theorist to what it exactly is that we're worried about with black holes. Another reason for why I want to think about energy in connection to black holes had to do a little bit with the episode that took place when the LHC experiment turned on, where there was this whole global news flash that black holes might get formed and that the Earth might be destroyed by the experiment. And it was quite remarkable, actually, how broadly that news was noticed. Anyone that I talked to, non-physicists, etc., knew about this, and it really meant something to them.
Someone killed themselves over it.
Some people killed themselves over it. And I got a phone call in the evening from a friend saying, okay, someone came to my house, and we have to call them because their son is in a state of panic. So it seems to be something that really sort of is part of the conscience of our broader society these days. And clearly, black holes apparently are scary. So why not try to turn the tide a little bit and turn them into something useful? So let's think about sort of what they can do for us. Besides sort of the conceptual questions of black holes, again, they're pretty spectacular objects. And in our universe, indeed, they are the most powerful generators of energy. So let's think about that from that perspective. And actually, I have a slightly different version of the motivations that I'll state in a second. But now, in our universe, we have black holes of all kinds of stripes. We've been talking about maybe quantum mechanical black holes, but black holes in active galactic nuclei, they can go up to whatever, 10 to the 9 solar masses. So these are pretty humongous things. And they generate an enormous amount of energy, something of the order of 10 to the 46, and then in these funny astrophysical units per seconds. Which is basically saying this thing is burning a couple of solar masses per year, and before you know it, you've burned quite a bit of matter. If you think about this, that there must be something pretty spectacular going on at these black holes. People are now excited about sort of new detections that people are doing with high energy cosmic rays. We would like to understand perhaps there's dark matter that's annihilating or decaying. And this goes into multi GeV range, and even go to the multi TeV range. Actually, we believe that there are astrophysical sources, rotating pulsars, or indeed black holes, that might be creating these very high energy objects. So it's certainly interesting physics, any physics that can lead to things that move with multi-TeV energies is interesting physics. And from a more fundamental perspective, when we really start thinking about astrophysical black holes, people indeed have been studying the physics of that, but then the fact that there is this horizon there, to us, of course, is a very deep conceptual puzzles associated with it. But for an astrophysicist, they just want to know, okay, how do we practically deal with this? And this was already mentioned a few times. So for astrophysics, people like Thorne and others introduced the membrane paradigm as a practical description of what the boundary condition is on a black hole horizon. But that's a bit of a crude description. If you want to think about the physics that generates all these huge amounts of energies from a more conceptual point of view, this may be a right time to start doing it, because since the time that people formulated the membrane paradigm, definitely we learned a lot more about what black holes horizons look like. So let's see if we look at it from a slightly fresh perspective right now. So after that introduction, let's think about the ways in which we can get energy from black holes. So the way we can extract energy, one, which is the most naive one, which I always thought was, and maybe it's the most dominant one in some ways as well, but not maybe the most interesting one, is simply to use the gravitational potential. And indeed, when you have an accretion disk and you throw stuff onto a black hole, the friction, essentially, the thing goes down and the friction heats up and it emits essentially the gravitational potential energy. And this way you can really sort of extract a lot of large fraction of the rest mass of stuff that's falling into the black hole. But this is outside of the black hole, so I'm not quite as much interested in that. And there are other mechanisms that really extract energy from black holes, but they refer actually to Kerr black holes. So you get rotation, then we know about the Penrose process, and something that was mentioned a few times, super radiance, which is sort of a radiative analog of the Penrose process. There's actually a very interesting astrophysics model for really what happens near one of these astrophysical black holes. Again, extracting energy out of the rotation, which is known as the Blanford-Snajak mechanism, which is quite fascinating, at least. And somewhat more conceptual, at least speculative, one other thing that people have considered was essentially what they call mining. This was Unruh and Walt had a paper on this, of the Hawking atmosphere. Where this is sort of was a bit of a theoretical exercise, where you take the Hawking atmosphere and you try to sort of take a bucket, imagine taking a weather bucket and just pulling the Hawking atmosphere out of the near horizon region. All of these mechanisms essentially are getting things out of the black hole, as opposed to this one. Although here you could sort of debate a little bit if you do it out of the Hawking atmosphere, whether you really take out of the Hawking, out of the horizon. But I'm going to ignore this thing anyway, because if you, one of the things that I want to be doing here, also a slight additional rule, is that I want to also think a little bit about how practical this mechanism is. And if you actually put in the numbers of how you would actually have to, what kind of bucket, how strong the rope has to be in order to pull out this Hawking atmosphere pull out the energy from the Hawking atmosphere, it's absurd. So this is kind of an absurd model. But these three, the Penrose, I guess, is mostly motivation. The two that I will discuss are these two, because they kind of seem like the most physically, I should say, realizable. This one is probably realized in nature, and the two are actually very closely linked, and they're mostly associated with electromagnetic processes, but in principle you could sort of generalize them to include other types of processes as well. Now, as a final motivational question, in case you get bored during my talk, here's a little homework for the next few hours. I could even make my question more general, but give you stick the laws of physics as you know it, and solve the energy problem of the world. That's your homework. And let me give it a little bit more concretely. Choose your favorite black hole, or let's say your favorite mass of a black hole. Pick a number that you like, and maybe some angular momentum, and make a black hole, allow power, extract energy from it as efficiently as you can, and try to do this with technology that looks reasonable, and see how much energy you can extract. It's a reasonable question to ask. And okay, we may discuss this later. But this is your okay, so let me move on to sort of what are the mechanisms that people thought about. And actually, the Penrose process, I should say, played a pretty important role in some of the debates that we've been having, because, of course, people in those days were very quickly to learn a lot about black holes. And indeed, as was discussed, there was the rules of black hole thermodynamics, and the Penrose process was actually one way of throwing stuff into a black hole, where seemingly the mass seemed to become less because you're extracting energy from it. But it's also slowing down the angular momentum of the black hole, and then there was this notion of irreducible mass, which essentially is the horizon area of the black hole that kept increasing. But there was an independent development, essentially Zaldovich, who already had some intuition, which I'll explain a little bit later, who thought about Kerr black holes. His intuition, in some sense, actually one could also think even as some version of the membrane paradigm or holography perhaps, where he understood that a rotating black hole can lead to this phenomenon of super radiance. And then people like Undo and Carter started, and Tucholsky, people like that, started studying this phenomenon more precisely. And actually, after that, Hawking came with his calculation, where indeed there was Hawking radiation. By the way, there's another way of extracting energy from black holes, which is Hawking radiation. I'm not including that here, but I should have written down that as well. But I want to be extracting energy in a way that I can amplify beyond the Hawking flux. So I want to be able to manipulate how much energy I'm extracting. So that's an additional requirement.
And this Zaldovich, after my talk, I was thinking, probably if you went back and looked at that, you could extract the temperature of the black hole.
Now, let me make
that. I'm not sure whether
if you do it completely, I think Unruh was getting very close to actually saying that things needed to have a temperature. One thing I should say, though, there's a very important difference between super radiance and Hawking radiation, is that with Hawking radiation, in order to derive the result, you actually need to include the dynamics of different frequencies. So frequencies are mixing up in the Bergoglio transformations that are associated with Hawking transformations, Hawking radiation. In the super radiance, you can all do it at a fixed frequency. Everything happens at just one single frequency, because we're actually looking at a stationary curve black hole. And super radiance already takes place there.
Right, but what I'm guessing is that if you already knew you had all the other evidence and you said there must be a temperature, we're looking for the right normalization.
That's right.
Of that, then you might be able to go back and this and
right.
Read it off. That,
Hawking actually went back to, he wanted to study the superradiation phenomenon in more detail, more generality, and came up with his famous paper.
That's also true, but I mean, even the result in itself
might
have the answer. So.
But the physics of it is very closely linked to that of the Planck, of the Penrose process. And the reason, of course, is that with a rotating black hole, there's this ergosphere where anyone who's inside of the ergosphere has to rotate along with the black hole, which means that there's no globally time-like Killing factor, which means that the local definition of energy, let me give it a hack here, is different than the energy that one would associate with an observer outside of the black hole would measure. The funny thing is that obviously, locally, if I have a particle and it has a certain amount of energy, it needs to be positive. This thing needs to be positive. But the relationship between these two guys is such that where omega is the rotation speed, and this is the angular momentum, if, for example, if the energy, if the angular momentum happens to be positive, then this local energy can be less than zero in case E is less than omega than J. Now, the point is that if I have a particle here, which is in this regime, which we call the superradiant regime, it actually, if it would make it into the ergosphere, it would have negative E hat, which is sort of locally impossible. So classical particles in this regime cannot make it into the ergosphere. So they bounce back. At least classical particle. But a wave can actually make it in. On the other hand, if I look at the other relation, which is the same relation but written like this, and if J is negative, the angular momentum, then E can be less than zero as long as if the local energy here is less than omega times J. So there are negative energy modes in the inside of the ergosphere. And what's actually important is precisely that these types of modes, the negative energy inside the atmosphere, and the ones that have positive asymptotic energy but negative local energy, they kind of do with each other. They're each other's antiparticle. And let me make that precise. So classically, these particles bounce off. So quantum mechanically, I can take a wave, send it in, e to the minus I omega R plus T, and then I get an outgoing mode, and I get, in principle, a mode that would go into the horizon. So let me write it here as an outgoing mode, as a reflection coefficient, T minus R, and then there's a transmission coefficient, where in terms of the local tortoise coordinates, one has an incoming mode where actually if this is the angular momentum of the mode, M is the angular momentum of the mode, this is this definition of the E hat. So this E hat can be negative if it's a superradiant regime. Now, if you think about it from a second quantized perspective, it means that if I have an incoming mode, let's call it A Danger Omega, which is the guy that, and you just keep Omega, it's just fixed. So A Dagger is a particle, it is a creation operator for an incoming photon. It can reflect back and create a B Dagger, which is a B Dagger that goes out, so A Dagger comes in, B dagger goes out. And then there's a mode here which I call C or C dagger, corresponding creation or annihilation modes. But depending on whether I'm in the superradiant regime or not, actually in the superradiant regime, since this frequency here is negative when measured for a local observer, this cannot represent a real particle because the real particle would have bounced back. It's a negative energy thing, so it's actually an annihilation mode. So the thing that sits here in the Bogota transformation is an annihilation, annihilates an E less than zero particle inside of the atmosphere. So here you can actually very quickly understand where super radiance comes from, because if you want to have a transformation like this, it's a Bogoyev transformation. If you require that all these operators satisfy the appropriate permutation relation, you get the relation that r squared is 1 plus t squared. Normally there's a minus sign there, because normally there's a c dagger here. But since there's now a c, there's a plus sign. And this tells you that the reflection coefficient is bigger than 1. It also tells you that the vacuum as seen by the infalling observer, at least if the initial condition is that A annihilates the vacuum, you'll actually find that the outgoing state must be some number times which is the ratio of R and T, some roughly times B dagger, C dagger on, the ingoing vacuum is this on the outgoing vacuum. So for a late time observer, he sees a pairs of particles, some which go into the horizon as negative energy particles, some that are escaping to infinity. So indeed, there's a flux of particles just already if you don't do anything. But what's kind of remarkable, and initially actually I was a bit confused about this, but in the end it's not anyone who's more familiar with this kind of stuff. So if I would take a state which has n incoming photons in it here, so if I have n of these guys, I act with those n times, and I measure how many outgoing particles there are in the quantum mechanics, you actually find that it's r squared times n plus t squared. That's an easy calculation. Initially I was confused about this super radiance a little bit, because the way it's initially formulated is just in terms of an initial wave whose amplitude when it comes back gets increased. But I know that for photons, at least if I put this thing in a big box, then an individual photon has a certain amplitude that's quantized by me because of h bar omega. At least we know what the amplitude of an individual photon is. So one photon cannot increase its amplitude. So if you send in stuff, you really need to get more photons back if you want to increase the amplitude. And that's indeed what happens. At the level of expectation values, you get more photons back than you send in. And it's actually sort of interesting to see, perhaps to think about how to visualize this. The way I like to visualize this is to say, well, let's write this r squared as 1 minus t squared plus 2 times t squared. And 1 minus t squared is the reflection coefficient that it actually just a single photon bounces back. And the 2 t squared comes from the fact that when it actually transmits into the ergosphere, there are sort of nonlinear optics. It splits into 2 photons and it comes out. But really, sort of what happens is that the way it goes into the ergosphere is by means of the absence of one of these negative energy particles. Anyway, it's a fascinating phenomenon, and it allows you to extract energy. And it has various types of consequences. And I briefly.
Yes. What's the frequency range in which you can get this effect? I mean, for small.
So omega less than m times j, m times omega. Now I should say, let me put a few numbers on it. If I take s equals 0, so scalar particles, then r squared is something like 1.001, so it's a very small effect. For spin 1, r squared is, I think, something like 1.04. At least these are maximal values. It means you have to be pretty close to this upper bound in order to reach that value. Actually, for gravitons, it's a pretty big effect. This R squared is 2.38, something like that.
This is all for modes on the scale of the size of the black hole itself, or the size of the ergosphere itself?
No, that depends on what M is, of course. If M is 1, which indeed is, I think, the dominant mode, then it's in the itself.
This question, for the meaning of EX, inside the ergosphere, the angular momentum can fluctuate, and omega is the chemical potential conjugate with
no, omega is, yeah, it's the angular velocity. You can think about it as the chemical potential of J, that's right. So J, omega indeed is something that even depends on where you are, at least locally. But this omega I mean here is the rotation velocity at the heart.
I'm saying why this EI is the right thermodynamic function
Now, I would just say if I'm a local observer and I would find a quantity for which E hat, I find a particle and I would measure the energy of the particle, then if I'm an observer down here, I would call this my energy. And the reason for that is that my time, the time my killing factor there is ddt. Right? So ddt hat, if you like, is ddt minus omega d phi. This is the time like filling factor inside.
Thermodynamic interpretation.
I'm sort of sidestepping a little bit to thermodynamics because I'm actually more interested in this late. This is maybe more thermodynamics. This d squared is sort of a thermal, it's related to the Hawking radiation. But I'm more interested, going to be interested in the amplification. So I want to sort of see how I can get stimulated emission. And the type of stimulated emission is multiplicative rather than additive.
Just one comment. This is known to some people under another name, Klein paradox.
It's called your derivative.
It's not really a paradox, it's just a fact.
No, it's just a fact, but it just means that
it's a paradox.
It's a paradox when it was first quantized, it was second quantized. Then it's no longer a
paradox. Your Gouliers like get power.
Okay.
I'll just remind you of this fact, probably Rob knows this much better than me. If instead of a black hole which has an ergo region, you had a star which had an ergo region.
Same.
Then by putting a mirror around it, you may be out of a bomb.
I was about to mention. So indeed, for example, there are various consequences that are associated with this. For example, indeed, in AES space-time, if you would make a small black hole, curved black hole, it's known to be unstable. There are different types of instabilities, of course, but this one is kind of super-radiant instability. And it's related to this black hole bomb point, namely if you emit these kind of modes, and the ADS acts like a spherical mirror, so it bounces back the modes and comes back to the horizon again, and then you again multiply by a factor of n. You keep multiplying it, and you get an exponentially growing mode in your radiation, and this is how indeed the present Tarkovsky trying to make the, or at least she used this notion of a black hole bomb. In principle, a physical phenomenon if you have a black hole, which obviously is one of the ways of trying to play this game, is if you take a black hole and it's small enough and you put a big spherical mirror around it. You build a laser.
I think the effect can happen in two different ways. I mean, either you have a black hole and you put a mirror outside, so each time something goes out, it gets re-amplified and you keep doing it. Or you don't need the mirror, but you have a star, not a black hole. So in that case, the members of the pairs which collect inside, they lead to the same Bose enhancement, and the thing goes exponential.
So if you have a star that's inside of this, you mean if you have...
So if there's no black hole, there's just a fast rotating star with an ergo region.
Yes.
You get the exponential growth without placing the mirror. Why is that? Because the members of the pairs which are inside, they look the same post. The ones which collect inside in the black hole, the ones which are going inside just disappear because they go past the horizon. But the other one, if you had a star, the members of the pair falling inside collect in there.
In fact, after
the exponential growth that Robin had found in this, sometime back in this Ross Microstream. The simplest non-instrument fuzzball that was shown you was 25 Ross. They explode exponentially for the same reason.
For the same reason, yeah.
And that for those guys, for example.
Although there was not a horizon, they still explode.
Correct. That, that condition was the operation for them. That's the example. So you can get the bomb into the fabric.
In fact, every in a perfect fluid approximation, every rotating star is unstable for this reason. It's associated with modes of the fluid itself.
Yeah.
The same sort of super radiation.
Yeah, I'll probably be mentioning this when I go.
It doesn't have to rotate fast enough
when I go to this.
No.
Any speed, any amount.
At any speed, there are such super radiating torque. Modes.
In every
unstable modes.
So in every?
In every rotating perfect fluid star.
What is the time delay in the phase of fire?
The phase of where it's sort of there is a notion of negative phase velocity in this region here, but I don't think that makes it out into so I think this part. You're worried about
the time in respect to the
I don't know. I would say this reflection is still mostly off the centrifugal barrier. Depends on J. So Dobich, who discovered this, at least I think there's more precise calculations were done by Kowalski and Fast, but Dobich, I think, is just this mechanism. But he had already an intuition earlier, just based on if I take a cylinder and my own sort of simplest way of understanding it, let's think about this lead as a. There was actually earlier the question, by the way, about whether the black hole horizon would be a perfect conductor. It's actually not. It's known that it has a finite resistance. It's known what that resistance is. And indeed, if I take a cylinder and I let it rotate and I give it some resistance, which means that the current density in the cylinder, so the charges on the cylinder, that in this case sigma is not the charge density, but it's the conductivity. Now, if I shine some light on top of this thing, this will lead to a linear term in the wave equation. So rather than just box A equals zero, that's I keep getting whether this is plus sign or minus sign. But the if this thing rotates, the linear term, the ddt term, would look like this. So normally, if it doesn't rotate, then this would be a friction term. But if omega minus m times omega turns negative, if this is less than zero, then this term, rather than being a friction term, becomes an amplification term. So indeed, a rotating charged conducting cylinder, if I shine light on it, super radius with the same point. So this was the intuition that Solovitz already had. So now let me go to the other mechanism, which is the Lambert-Snejec, which is more astrophysical. And again, I always thought again that the main power source of these active nuclei would be this effect of just matter in the accretion disk. But it turns out that quite a bit of it, and maybe the most interesting part, the most fundamental part, really comes from inside of the black hole in some ways. And if you look at the astrophysical Kerr black hole, and I think in the picture that Tom had yesterday, it kind of looked like this. There was some stuff rotating around it, but he also was indicating this characteristic jet that comes out of it. And essentially what happens in this jet is that the inner region here, indeed there's a big pointing flux of energy that goes out of in that jet. And that pointing flux really sort of comes out of the core of the black hole, really comes out of the black hole, which naively, again, if you wouldn't have known about that story, would be surprising, because if there's a pointing flux, there has to be particles that carry that flux. So there have to be photons that basically are carrying that pointing flux out. And how can they make it out of the black hole horizon? And obviously they make it out of the black hole horizon because of this mechanism. It's actually negative energy photons that are coming in here. Of course, there's a lot of stuff happening here. There's, again, the accretion disk. Then there's whatever, all kinds of transitions here. There's called the torus region, plunging region. And then there are jets of matter that also take out. There's some funnel here. But the main physics is that the rotation of the Kerr black hole indeed gets increased by at least the accretion process spins up the black hole. And then, but that same rotational energy is being carried off by the pointing clocks. So there's both a spin up effect and a spin down effect. And the spin down effect is the thing that at least extracts energy really from inside of the now, typically, I would want to stay far away from anything in astrophysics because it sort of it gets dirty when you go into the details. But I sort of got interested in it, and I studied a bit more these papers, and they're actually very beautiful. So I'm going to show you a little bit about how all of that works, where even dirty astrophysics can turn out to be quite interesting. And there are actually conceptual issues involved in that as well. People are still kind of debating this whole mechanism. And some of that has to do with the fact that the membrane paradigm, I think that work by Thorne and his company was largely motivated, actually, by putting this thing on some sort of more fundamental footing, or at least to provide a practical way of closing all the equations in that context. But it's also going to be interesting from the point of view of the Kerr CFT correspondence, and maybe more generally the AAC correspondence, is to just see if I can actually build one of these astrophysical type of black holes inside of the bulk, and just ask, okay, well, what's the boundary dynamics that corresponds to this kind of phenomenon? And of course, people have already started doing this kind of stuff. There's a connection between hydrodynamics on the boundary, finite temperature, plasmas, and things like that. You can put that plasma into rotation. But the key point that's actually going to make this thing work is indeed that there's also a magnetic field that you need. So you have magneto-hydrodynamics taking place here. And indeed, this rotating accretion disk creates that magnetic field. And actually, yeah, there's a there's an instability when you have a rotating plasma like this, which really creates a pretty big magnetic field now. And the mechanism that leads to the radiation, let me sort of write it down mainly here, because then I can worry later about sort of deriving it. But let me already give you sort of the holographic point of view of what the mechanism is. Again, the same situation. So it's closely related to the super radiance. But so again, we have the rotation. But now let's apply a magnetic field. And for simplicity, let's just make the magnetic field to be radially outwards. Okay? Now, there's all kinds of stuff rotating here. So effectively, what happens is that this magnetic field also rotates. But it rotates at a slightly different angular velocity than the actual fluid. So E, which points up, the electric field, is omega times V. And this means that if I rotate along with this omega, in that rest frame, there will be no electric field. But now, if I go to the rest frame of the fluid, so the fluid is rotating with that angular velocity omega, I still have a radial magnetic field B, but because of the Lorentz transformation, I'm going to the rotating frame, at least locally, as with the Lorentz transformation, I get an electric field that now points down, and this E in the rest frame of the fluid is proportional to omega, little omega, Oh yeah, I already changed the sign. Big omega minus omega times that original B, times B. There you go.
So because the Lorentz transform is the B points radially outwards in all directions?
Yes.
Okay, so a couple of there is a divergence of B which is non-zero in the center?
Yeah, here dealing with a cylinder. Yes. But to be honest, one can fix things up by just this is a local perspective. So Blankford and Snedjak actually they indeed considered something that they call that's called the monopolar solution, where essentially just flux is going out.
So you can make a monopolar solution for ordinary.
Yeah, but actually then later on at least the actual solution that they have is what they call a split monopole solution. So they take the upper half of a monopole in the north, and the lower half of the opposite monopole in the south. Which means that they actually have a current that goes around in this equatorial disk. So people started improving this, but locally to understand the mechanism.
So I guess the other thing I don't understand is if the B is radial, what does it mean by saying it's rotating? If you rotate it, it says exactly where it is, right? I mean, a radial field pointing already in all directions. It's not changing with time, right?
What I'm saying is there's a rest frame in which there's no electric field. If I'm a charged particle, and I move, and I would be rotating, I would feel a force due to that. It's the Hall effect. But the key thing is again that in the rest frame of the fluid, that the electric field is actually pointing in the opposite direction as the electric field in the rest frame, at least in the lab frame.
The particles are rotating, not the B is rotating, but the particles are rotating.
Particles are rotating. There's a lab frame and there's a current and there's a flow. But this shows you that there's going to be a current that goes in this direction, and that current J is proportional to again my conductivity times omega minus omega times B, because it's sigma times the electric field. But it goes down, which means that it also goes down here, and therefore there's a power. Being in this case actually dissipated because the current goes against the electric field. So E dot J is proportional to omega times big omega minus omega times V squared. Just plugging in this, plugging in that. So there's a power being emitted, extracted from the black hole. And this is indeed the formula, exactly the formula that derived, but the physics.
And power is coming out in what way? As waves.
So they don't include radiation in the discussion, but it goes out. You get it as a pointing vector E cross B. By the way, here I'm writing it as E dot J because I have a cylinder, but eventually in the actual electromagnetic formulation, then this magnetic current is actually replaced. This is actually a pointing vector, so I'm writing it as E cross B. And again, I'm getting ahead of myself, but it's similarly as earlier, we had that charge density in a holographic membrane paradigm is related to the perpendicular electric field. The current density is related to the magnetic field. So this is really sort of a holographic point of view of what actually taking place inside it. By the way, if you plug in numbers, if this is 10 to the 4 Gauss, that's sort of something you can quickly get. Put in other numbers, for example, this kind of mass, you need to get this amount of energy. So that's why this mechanism sort of gets the right order, at least. Okay, I'm going to do this sort of quickly, but I decided to give you a little bit of a flavor of the derivation, or at least of really what magnetic hydrodynamics looks like in the bulk, and how we can actually solve at least a version of really, at least formulate things in a way where one can really study what's going on. So, let me write down my method. By the way, one philosophy you need that one can apply here is, okay, well, we're going to do this maybe for Kerr, but maybe we're interested in other types of rotating black holes, maybe ADS-type black holes, or indeed, taking the near horizon limit in the end, near horizon extreme occur. So let's do it all generally. So this is a rotating two-dimensional space, and I'm adding the radial and theta direction more generally like that. So this is my space-time. There's a velocity which I want to introduce, which is omega times dd phi. Phi is the local rotation velocity of the space-time. Okay. Now, in addition to just having a space-time, of course, I'm going to have an electromagnetic field. And in one way of doing things somewhat coordinate, I'm trying to do something somewhat coordinate independent, because that helps me actually sometimes with understanding what's going on. So rather than using too many indices, let me write down the F as a two form. But I'm working in a 3+1 formalism, which indeed is what people are doing, because with space-time, it's axiosymmetric, but we're going to treat time sort of separately from space. There's a star F, which I could write as d minus h times dt, the usual other dual electric field and magnetic field. And then there's a Lagrangian, in this case, which is just E dot d minus b dot h. Or maybe it's not b dot h. I think it's b dot h. Okay, but in addition to having an electromagnetic field, I'm going to have currents. So, by the way, if I initially, I'm going to be working towards an ADS-CFT type dual. And of course, if I have a geometry, okay, well, I have some, maybe some CFT if I take the near horizon geometry, but in addition, I'm going to have an electromagnetic field, which means that I have currents in the boundary theory in the U1. A U1 symmetry with associated currents. But in the book, I'm also going to have charged fields. Yes, indeed, actually in this magnetohydrodynamics, for sure, there's lots of pack creation actually taking place and lots of charged particles moving around. So I'll have a current, and that makes things quite complicated. But what people initially do, that's at least to get started, you assume that everything is force-free, so that the admin nu times j nu is equal to zero. And what that actually means is that if I would go to the rest frame of the moving particles, that there's no electric field. And if I can, if that's true, that I can go to the rest frame of the particles, there's no electric field. But I'm also looking at stationary current flow. Then the electric field E dot B would be equal to zero. So this is called the degenerate field. And just fiddling with it a little bit. Oh, by the way, if this is the case, then indeed quite generally, if I work in a slightly sort of abstract notation, so then there's this, say if I have velocity v, which is another rotation velocity, which in this case, again, I'm assuming will be in the axial, I want to maintain axial symmetry. So the electric field, again, is kind of the field lines are moving with an angular velocity omega, which may, by the way, be a function of r and phi. All these things could be functions of r and phi, I'm sorry, r and theta, but not functions of phi, acting on b. So this tells me this is a solution to that equation. And then this equation will tell me that if I take the three form, let me call it mu, which is essentially the square root of the three of the spatial metric, so it's the volume form of my three dimensional volume, I can make a two form current, which I call J, and then this thing. Condition can be solved by saying that the two-form current minus the charge density times, sorry, J is two form, U is also a two form, and essentially it's the velocity associated with the motion of the electric lines is equal to some function. And this is not this is something that we know about, that if you are in a force-free approximation, then the particles are essentially moving along the magnetic field lines. So this is telling you that the currents are along the magnetic field lines. And actually, this equation can be written eventually in an elegant Lagrangian form, which gives some hint about perhaps also the relation with the boundary theory. So again, what we have is a magnetic field, and we have current J, and because of this degeneracy assumption, I'm giving myself this other function omega, and then I have the electromagnetic field. And now I want to be able to solve all these equations. But I will make a decomposition now in something that in the literature is called the toroidal part, which is the radial and theta directions, and what's called the toroidal part. So GT is a piece that goes along the, along the cylinder, along the axial direction like that. That's the toroidal part. This orthogonal part, since B for me is a two form, I can write it as follows, as B phi, big phi times B little phi, and the interpretation of that big phi is nothing else than if I have some surface, and this is again a circle where phi goes like this. So I'm looking at, say, at a surface around the black hole. There's a total amount of magnetic flux that goes through here. And that integral up to an angle theta and radial position r is that function phi. So phi is the integral of magnetic flux. And I can do something similar with the current density. And this thing is dI times d phi, because similarly, if I integrate the magnetic and electric current over the surface, I get the total current. So I is the integral of J. And this particular equation, that the current must be in the direction of the magnetic field, will give me a relation that dI is actually F times d phi. And it tells me that this function F can be derived once I know the current. Now, for the rest, it's just a matter of solving Maxwell's equation. Once I would know the current that goes through here, I also know this part of the magnetic field just by Ampere's law. If I integrate the magnetic field around that circle, I know it's equal to the total current. And then you have the other equation. This thing turns out to be an equation that one can write as an equation of motion for some action principle where something is equal to zero. And let me give you that action. And that action is nothing else than just plugging in the solution that I gave over there into this expression for the action. And you get a formula like this. Let me write down here. In the end, by the way, the equations that one really gets are quite, some of them actually look very long, but the basic information is all encoded in this action. that's it. Where V one minus omega minus omega squared. Alpha and gamma are defined here. Oh, the big omega is defined there. So what do I have? I have three sets of data. I have phi, that's my variable. I have a function omega phi that I can choose. And it is obtained by solving this equation, and that chooses a particular omega phi. And I have a current I of phi, which in principle I could choose. So if I would give myself these two quantities, these two functions, then I could solve the equation of motion of this action, and I'll get the magnetic flux as a function of theta. Or I could do something else. I could give myself the magnetic flux as a function of theta. I can give myself omega as a function of phi, and then I can solve for the current. Which is maybe the physical way you want to do it. You assume that there's a certain electromagnetic field. And from a holographic point of view, that's maybe the way you want to do it. Because this system, again, is some kind of charged hydrodynamical system. And certainly from an ADS-CFT point of view, the electromagnetic field would what you would call the non-normalizable modes, and there are fixed boundary conditions. So I give myself the electromagnetic field, and the electromagnetic field will give me the phi, and it will give me the omega, and then the system will do does what it does, and will give me the current.
So you know the current from the decreasing modes and the fixed the phi. They are the conjugates.
Yes. So let me briefly write down that dictionary. The holographic dictionary is that the radial electric field, say so what I've done up to now, I've actually solved the equations in the bulk. So I have my near horizon geometry, and I'm sitting in the bulk, and I'm solving electromagnetism, force-free electromagnetism with a charge in the bulk. And now I want to make a dictionary to what sits on the boundary. And the radial electric field, as we know via Gauss's law, is the, let me put a hat here because it's of the boundary theory. So the charge density, which is the surface charge density in this case, on the boundary, is related to the radial component of the theta component of the magnetic field. Again, this doesn't mean anything in a 2+1 dimensional in a two-dimensional boundary theory. In a two-dimensional boundary theory, I only have a radial component of the electric of the magnetic field, and I have two components of the electric field. But anyway, there's this dictionary that listing this. And in terms of the variables that I have here, this would be omega dr phi. This would be dr of phi. And then the phi component of the magnetic field would be associated with the theta component of the current, and this is actually the I variable that I have. And then my external boundary conditions, if I look at external things that I can choose, which are B, the radial component of the B field, the theta component of the E field, which I assume is omega 10 PR. And in this discussion, I've been putting the phi component equal to zero because of this integration. But anyway, this defines the boundary condition, and then the equation of motion that you get here would solve the current. Now, in the bulk, by the way, I've taken now a force-free electromagnetism equation. In the boundary, again, there's a similar type of system in the sense that there's a boundary theory which is also charged currents. But the fact that I have charged currents in the bulk probably implies some pretty complicated dynamics in the boundary. My guess is, by the way, that this, if I would look at what this looks at the boundary, it's indeed magnetohydrodynamics, But with viscosity, with turbulence, it's probably a pretty complicated system. But it's an interesting question. What kind of boundary dynamics does this thing correspond to? But when I go back to the question, okay, why this thing actually extracts energy, then I just completely go back to this particular intuition, is that the way in which I'm extracting energy from this boundary system is exactly by this
analog. So what would be the analog of the matter which is getting that charge density rho in the boundary theory from which you're able to get the energy out? What kind of matter would give that charged cylinder?
What kind of matter would be?
Corresponding to the charged cylinder.
So the holographic dictionary that I'm applying, and I have to admit that for the case of the pure CFT, I would have to think a little bit more deeply about it. But suppose that this were a black hole in ADS, a rotating black hole in ADS. Then, in order to make a rotating black hole in ADS, you actually start with a boundary fluid, and you make the fluid.
So the fluid is just made from Yang Mills stuff.
It's made from Yang Mills stuff, and you make it just rotate like that.
But it will be charged under a U1 gauge field.
So there will be a global. So the boundary theory will have a U1 symmetry. Actually, in this case, it has an SO6 symmetry. But anyway, it's like and so there's charged matter under that.
There's fundamental matter under that, fundamentally charged matter.
No, as long as it can give a current, at least for a given U1 current. The boundary theory has a U1 current. And then what I do is I just turn on classical electromagnetic fields coupled to that U1 current. And I am in this situation that will already start extracting stuff. Now, obviously, there's maybe some conceptual questions that come here because this mechanism seems rather general. But in the case of the explanation in terms of the bulk theory, the presence of an ergosphere seems quite essential. So one should be able to match exactly whenever there's an ergosphere, you would expect that the boundary theory would actually allow you to do this. Whereas if there's no ergosphere,
and how do you see the difference in the boundary theory? How is the difference between having or not having an ergosphere?
I can't say much else than just making this particular comment. There was one other comment that I wanted to make.
Is this dictionary just done by analogy with the other cases, or it's just some trivial sort of, it's just an obvious thing because when you specialize to the boundary?
You mean the holographic dictionary?
Yeah.
There are two ways of understanding in holographic dictionary. One is as follows, is that if I give fixed values to, say, I have a boundary and the phi component of the boundary vector potential actually is equal to this magnetic flux phi. That phi is actually the phi component of the boundary vector potential. By Stokes' theorem. And if I give this thing a non-trivial value, so I have my boundary theory and I turn on an A of phi, what it means is that in terms of the partition function or any other correlation function, I'm actually looking at the system in the presence of this potential that's dual to the current. And therefore, if I were to differentiate this with respect to phi, with respect to A phi, I get J of phi. But the canonical dual, the pi of the dual to this variable, is essentially, if you would think about the ADS direction as time, then the R of phi effectively acts like differentiating with respect. So the R of phi becomes identified with the current. And this is sort of in the holographic dictionary, but if you think about it really as a boundary condition in a full three-dimensional space, again, this condition you can understand. This follows from Gauss's law. By the way, this you could also understand from this other explanation that I just gave a moment ago. And same thing, by putting A0 here and rho there, that the radial variation of A0 is the conjugate to the charge. But this equation here also just follows from Gauss's law, if I think about it, as the boundary closing off some three-dimensional electric field. Similar these follow from Ampere's law. So there's a rather precise dictionary when it comes to how bulk fields are identified with expectation values of currents, how radial variations of boundary fields are associated with expectation values.
So is this actually, so to speak, a derivation of the dictionary? It's not just a ansatz, or it's not a guess or something like that.
Yeah, it's not I wouldn't call this it's a dictionary, it's not a duality.
It's not a duality.
Or at least it's a little bit like a duality in the sense that I'm using other variables and I'm doing something physical at the boundary. But by the way, this kind of dictionary would also apply again with this stretch horizon or the membrane parameter. If indeed I want to do something with electromagnetic fields, and I want to just have them end myself consistently on some boundary, this is exactly what you sort of self-consistent way of relating both the boundary.
On the gravity side, if you actually, whenever you get one of these pair creation stories, you always find a zero norm mode. I mean, under the indefinite norm which you use to quantize on the gravity side, I think you always get a zero norm mode when you're going to get any of these creation issues. I'm wondering if there's a corresponding thing like that which you can identify on the CFO.
Yeah, okay, probably to get some plus minus stability. I don't know, but you mean that there's a zero norm mode here?
Yeah, that's sort of your clean signal that you're going into the phase of what is normally doing any kind of quantification in the curve. So I'm wondering if that also shows up as zero norm mode.
Yeah, and this other intuition that Zolovich had, that any fluctuation, if this boundary field would be fluctuating, then you might, in this super radiant regime, might again have an amplified solution. I'm not sure if that's related, but anyway. By the way, this is stuff that I still always be a work in progress and sort of more reviewing and really giving you lots of new insights with regard to the precise holographic interpretation. But it's clear that at least there's a dictionary that one can start building up here. And it would be interesting, clearly, if one would have a more deeper understanding of what kind of boundary dynamics would be associated with this kind of business. Questions? So let me slowly start wrapping, just conclude. Again, as I said, a lot of the literature, at least recently, certainly in applications of ADS-CFT, what people have been doing is taking a particular strongly coupled realization of boundary phenomena, and people have been looking at quantum Hall effects. People have been looking at hydrodynamic rotating fluids in the and people started actually looking at McNeil hydrodynamics. There are some papers actually by Alex Rico and collaborators that have started doing some of these things, looking at per ADS black holes and other papers by Clem and collaborators, where they even have a magnetic charge involved as well. In their case, they're not finding any of the super radiant behavior because of their boundary condition. Basically, they take this big little omega to be equal to big omega, and then it has no flux coming up. But if you would take a slightly different boundary condition in their analysis, you should be able to find this kind of behavior. But it would clearly be interesting if one can, start applying ADS-C type ideas to these astrophysical questions, and then essentially return to what people were doing in the membrane paradigm and get more precise about what properties one can derive. And for example, with the Kerr CFT correspondence, again, this asymptotic symmetry group is an additional structure that goes on top of this, because all of this had to do with the electromagnetic properties mostly. But combining that with the knowledge of CFT is very useful. Way forward to make a small step towards sort of doing the astrophysics. Let me stop there with my talk.
Any more questions?
What kind of question do you think you can solve? So it is just a translation or the language or
No,
these are not within classical system.
Yeah, so there are several questions that people have when it came to, for example, this particular project process. So Rapid and Snezek already mentioned, okay, well, they're a bit puzzled about what really is slowing down the black hole, because they're working in a force-free approximation, so that any charged particle that's outside of the black hole doesn't feel any force on it. So what is doing the frictional dynamics? And they already noticed that frictional dynamics has to take place inside of the horizon. Now that sounds odd. And again, as I said, this is one of the motivations for the membrane paradigm, because one of the statements that people made in those days was precisely that the horizon is a system with finite conductivity. So it's unsatisfactory to just say, well, okay, that's the only statement. Do you want to sort of understand from a more microscopic point of view what really leads to the physics that takes place very close to the horizon? Another point is the following, is that this is all sort of classical, and we actually know that the horizon is the Hawking atmosphere. You would have to sort of maybe think about, again, the finite temperature effects, the fact that when you're really very close to the horizon, that whatever point scale physics might even be important. So having a way of embedding this inside of the theory that we know would be a dual representation of quantum gravity on the black hole horizon. That's a way of putting this. So from the astrophysics point of view, and how should I say, putting that in a more fundamental and subsistent framework, I think that's one motivation. The other motivation, at least for myself, is that what people now, a lot of people are now doing, is they're looking at boundary phenomena, condensed matter type phenomena, and trying to model that, for example, or the Rick type physics. Okay, it's a certain application, and it's rather interesting to actually not only have an interesting boundary system that you want to study, but even the bulk physics in itself has some physical aspects to it as well. Coming back to say the theme of the workshop, again, energy is not the same thing as information. So indeed, there are much more detailed and much more deeper questions that one would have to address if you want to sort of focus on the information aspect of it. I think it's an interesting new ingredient into the discussion, and it's in particular since it's kind of is associated with a similar kind of phenomenon. That's another place where certainly some lessons can be learned.
Let me just come back to something I was asking somebody before. So whenever you have any partial creationists in the time paradox, you do get this thing that the correlation system fails because F and F star are no longer the ones with the Poisson bracket 1. It's F with some other G which becomes 1. And you know, so all these things are sort of, whenever all these things happen, that's what you see on the mathematical side. But do you know any way of identifying any of these processes, maybe not exactly in this system, but what do the dual languages look like of particle creation in any system? Is that understood in any way?
Okay, let me make, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question at all, but let me make one comment that may be related. So in the cursory T correspondence, as Tom was mentioning, there are earlier calculations where people have essentially reproduced this super radiance effect from sort of a near horizon calculation. Montesena astrology a long time ago did calculations, and I guess you're familiar with other works around, and you like to look at that stuff and also rock. But so what people write down as the emission amplitude for emitting an extra mode from some near horizon theory at some frequency, they look at a two-point function of the dual operator, and this is essentially applying Fermi's golden rule. You write down something like this. And then you can at least see that under actually a particular assumption that in the cursory T correspondence, let me briefly mention this in the proper expression. If you, in the boundary coordinates that are used in the cursory T correspondence, if you take a mode that's just some oscillating mode in the boundary theory, like that, I'm taking notation of Tom and collaborators' paper, they identify the left mover quantum number with the angular momentum, as you would expect, but the right mover quantum number is, again, up to some rescaling equal to this famous combination. And again, so their local energy that they're using here is actually this E hat energy. But nonetheless, one can do a calculation where you see that the system emits super radiant modes. But the reason for that, for finding that, is that in this integral you're doing an I epsilon prescription. You have to choose an I epsilon prescription. And the I-epsilon prescription that you use is appropriate for dividing positive and negative frequency in this omega. If I would be dividing a positive and negative frequency, if I go to a vacuum relative to this NR, I would find zero. And really has to do with the boundary, it has to do with your atomic boundary condition, whether or not the system really emits. So this is a little bit of a disappointing conclusion, because you kind of sort of put it in by hand almost that this system would super here.
I guess that's because it's using the vacuum.
But it's the vacuum that, at least from the local perspective, you would not necessarily see. And it's not that surprising, because the near horizon curve geometry, the Anhang geometry, sits inside of the atmosphere. And it, everything comes from essentially having both regions in first space time.
Does a Bogolyubov transformation in the bulk look like a Bogolyubov transformation in the boundaries?
They may still be connected, at least, but not quite in this particular example. This would be an example, as Tom was mentioning, where you could relate to low frequency emission for low frequencies omega. If you go to higher frequencies, they have more Tom and collaborators have more understanding of a relationship between these separating phenomena and string effect creation inside of the bulk of the near horizon geometry. So when you have actually string effect creation inside of the bulk of the geometry, I assume that also the manifestation in the boundary theory will be a bit more dramatic than this.
Sorry, taking a phenomenological point of view, like the way that people do in Higgs-Pitness kind of stuff, have people tried to add angular momentum to the finite temperature solutions that they have, just, you know, phenomenologically?
Yeah, the people have studied rotating fluids. People have studied magnetic hydrodynamics, at least certainly with charged magnetic black holes. I think that, as I mentioned, there's also some papers, recent papers, where they need to get looked at the thermodynamic type properties of that's dual to a pure Newman ADS black hole. But again, they have not studied this particular type of boundary conditions because in that case they look at the situation that does not lead to Higgs's radiation. The people have started, this is just work in the last 2 months. People have started doing this. And in principle, indeed, there are magnetic hydrodynamic equations on the boundary, which indeed are not force-free, meaning that you can derive that the stress energy tensor of the has an external force acting on it. So indeed, this equation is true for the boundary theory. So there's all kinds of dynamics going on the boundary theory that you can derive.
Your boundary surface is time-like in this setup?
Yes.
So, but of course, the really, I mean, getting back to this, doing a more fundamental treatment or something, the actual horizon is null, physically. It's a null surface. And in fact, I think there was, I can't remember clearly, but I think before this membrane paradigm, there was work by, I think it was Damore and
Carter
also did the more exact treatment where the horizon was actually null. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of...
No, more exact treatment. But, so what happens if, for example, if you take this particular system, this alpha goes to zero at the horizon, and indeed there's a boundary condition, essentially the radial component of the contribution from here, from the radial component of radial grid of pi, drops out, and that's the boundary condition that people are imposing on the horizon, which actually is still a bit of a small point of debate, but at least it's something that you can derive. But it's similar to ADS-CFT in the sense that the actual horizon is embedded in this duals, at least in the holographic dictionary, it's in the bulk. So you're including the dynamics of the horizon, which is a little bit outside of it. In that effect, it's like the stressed horizon.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm just wondering if there's some version where you don't have to stretch the horizon. You might even...
That would be like boosting to infinite, really taking away the Planck scale cutoff. I think there's probably something fundamental about why you want to do this.
But this is just classical. I mean, what you're showing us is just classical physics. So.
It is classical physics, although there must be
a description. In fact, you might even speculate, well, this would be completely based on speculation maybe, but you might speculate that it has something to do with the kind of ADS-CFT thing in an asymptotically flat space-time, because there the boundary really is null.
Again, the reason I'm doing classical physics is because also in ADS-CFT, people, when they look at doing bulk physics, I was doing the bulk physics of the ADS-CFT in analogy. But people still assume that in a large n limit, it's describing actually some strongly coupled boundary dynamics. So the quantum, whatever, the strongly coupled physics comes in once I start representing these quantities in terms of boundary degrees of freedom. So if I would know what the dual system is, what the boundary system really is, then that would be my definition of the whole thing. And then this classical discussion would just be an approximate discussion and I would start improving on that. But I don't think in this case that it's actually very practical to take this null case, the null limit. And I don't think it would be a more exact way. Similar as people in the stressed horizon were actually deliberately keeping away from probably pretty fundamental reasons.
Well, I think in that booklet, I think what they said is that it was sort of more expressing it in a way that after physicists could understand or something.
Yeah, yes, it is. It seems somewhat insulted by it. By just being giving a spoon fed a recipe rather than an explanation. But I don't think I can improve on that. But again, in ADS-CFT, there's a clear reason for why the ADS space is there at some level, because you want to have this, like the talk yesterday from Mauro, you want to have a time evolution on your boundary. And things get complicated, that's no place. Although there seems to be some null aspects to your boundary. Something goes a bit funny in this.
This is a question that might be related to that last comment, but I hadn't realized before you made the comment that the near care solution is entirely inside the ergosphere. Did you say that?
Right.
I think that the ergosphere, or in that picture, the ergosphere comes down and touches the horizon at the axis. So is there something funny that happens there? Is that what this comment was?
I think there is something funny. So we were talking about this yesterday, but I think that the near horizon sort of includes a part of the ergosphere near the poles. I mean, a part that goes outside
of the native pole, maybe. Yeah, you may be right.
Yeah. Which doesn't, it's not clear how that can happen because the ergosphere doesn't touch until the actual
right.
pole, whereas the near horizon is. But if you look at the Killing vectors in the near horizon, it looks like sort of instead of finding an ergosphere at small r, you sort of find out an ergosphere at the other poles. I think somehow it must be
over. So it's sort of somehow the axis, there's something funny there. Or there's really a cone.
It's not even, you know, it's not infinitesimally near the poles. It's
By the way, there are other interesting surfaces besides the boundary of the atmosphere. If in real astrophysical time, like poles, again, I've been talking about the region where this omega is less than that big omega, but once you move farther out, away from the horizon, there's actually a point where the two things start changing, where this omega becomes bigger than that. And there's all kinds of interesting factors in physics taking place at that point as well. And there's also an interesting surface where this thing goes zero. But for example, the mechanisms that create these high energy cosmic rays indeed are associated with that surface where essentially the rotation speed divides some of it. The speed co-rotating with this thing would be the speed of light, and that's where things are really in the center. But there's still, and perhaps even within these kind of situations, you might put that point inside of the bulk somewhere. And maybe that's roughly it, more what's going on with some of these super radiant modes, although in your case, but I'm not sure.
So, Herman, one proposal was to move the discussion in the distro?
That's the
best. Okay, so let's go upstairs, but before that, let's thank Herman again. Good job.